show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. Good morning to you, Connor. How you doing?
I'm doing all right, Earl.
All right, that's good to hear. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. Sandy, I think we got the right date now.
Yeah, it's not Tuesday. I've been doing the Tuesday thing for a while. It's confusing.
Yeah, how you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. All right.
You know, there's so much to talk about, so many different areas to go in, but I wanted to begin this show with talking. The 2-year anniversary of us.
January 6th. Well, I mean, actually, every year is the anniversary of January 6th, but we're talking about the invasion of the Capitol on January 6th. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. So, you know, the thing that surprises me is that, number one, it's been 2 years, and number two, that it's taken 2 years for the government processes to release a report. It's really just been a matter of weeks since the committee that was investigating January 6th released the report. And the astounding thing to me is, I mean, they have come up with a lot of startling information, a lot of startling factual information showing the intrigue that lay behind it. But the Americans generally watch that unfold. We watch the rally on TV, the president calling the people at the rally, calling them to the rally. We watch the tweets that he put out, telling people that something wild and exciting was going to happen in Washington on January 6th. Everyone knew what the importance of the January 6th date was. It was the day for the Electoral College vote to be counted and cast. And so, it's astounding to me that we've gotten kind of nowhere in the process, and hopefully something will come of this, and you know, I guess the ultimate measure of that will be if we can if Donald Trump ends up not being the nominee of the Republican Party and ends up disappearing into the netherworld of politics. But so far, that hasn't happened. We still are talking about Donald Trump. In fact, yesterday, during this folly of a vote on the new Speaker of the House, that one of them cast their vote for Donald Trump.
You know, Sandy, none of these things. You know, we it's kind of like public theater, what we've been dealing with all of this.
It's somewhere between tragedy and comedy, and it's unfortunately the worst of both.
Yeah, 2 years later, it's almost like yesterday, right? I mean, I think what happened on...
like I said, though, off the air, 2 years... Garbage goes bad long before 2 years. This garbage has been out for 2 years now, and we're suddenly now thrust back into talking about it and focusing on it. And everyone, I think, hoped that the horror of the January 6th incident would be in the rearview mirror. A lesson would have been learned from it, and we would have moved on. But it's not the case. You know, this race for speaker, In many respects, is an echo of the January 6th problem. The sort of super right wing faction of the Lauren Boebert of the world, the people who were actually backing the January 6th insurrection, are now calling the dance in the Republican caucus, where to the point of having 11 votes and probably going on to 12 and 13 today.
You know, Sandy, do you ever see an end to that faction of the Republican Party? In your opinion, are they going to get stronger, or do you think at some point in time that, you know, once Donald Trump is really, you know, kind of off the radar, and there's going to come a time, you can even see signs of it now, that Donald Trump is not as prominent as he once was. He's he's still making noise, but you know, his howl is fainting, right? I mean, I think really he shows the vestiges of a person who is fading away.
Well, I think he's fading, and now we have to find out whether the movement that was behind him. Either, you know, there's two different issues here that you can look at this two different ways. Donald Trump was the leader of movement. You lose Donald Trump, you lose the movement. Or Donald Trump was actually a symptom of a movement, and I fear it's the latter, that there remain these, the Lauren Boberts of the world, the people, and that the wheels that were started with the Trump movement are going to be hard to stop. And I think what's happening now with the speaker race is that it's exposing the problem we have with the two-party system in which the parties are quite evenly divided in numeric numbers, and we have wings of the party who therefore can exercise a great deal. You know, we've got 20 members of Congress from the Republican Party who are essentially calling the dance on the speaker vote. And that wouldn't be the case if those 20 members were simply the members of a third or fourth minority party, and we were having to form a consortium like they do in the parliaments in many other countries across the world. It would be a much different dynamic.
You know, Sandy, as you watch a system that I think something's wrong with the system that 218 or 14 or so people say this is, the majority says this is what we want. We're in a majority rules kind of system. How is it then possible that these 5-10 people can?
Well, here's the problem. Yeah, a majority rules. It takes 218 votes to adopt put into place the Speaker of the House. And normally the majority party has been able in caucus to reach a consensus and move forward because they've decided, well, we're going to do this. And maybe there'd be disagreement or unhappiness within the caucus, but they all knuckle under and they all vote on a consensus basis. This is what we're going to do. And now what we've got is a party that's fractured. And, you know, the Democratic Party is possibly more unified, but not completely unified. This could happen in reverse down the road, where you've got a faction in the party that says, you know what, we want our way, and it's going to be our way or the highway with respect to getting a Speaker of the House. You know, one of the frightening things is one of the conditions that's apparently trying to be imposed by this conservative group is a Speaker who promises that they will shut down the government on the national debt limit issue if these people don't get their way with respect to the kind of legislation they want adopted that would be viewed from their standpoint as reducing expenditures. Now, who knows what that is? Is it Social Security they want to get reduced? Is it Medicare they want reduced? What are the various social expenditures that they think need to be reduced in order to avoid the national debt? Because you understand the national debt is the result of bills that have already been passed. So it isn't like you can just not pass additional bills and avoid bumping up against the national debt limit. No, no. The national debt limit is being bumped up against and needs to be increased because of laws that have already been passed. So the notion that this faction is saying, no, we've got to shut down the government because we need our way with respect to legislation that gets adopted, or otherwise we'll shut down the government.
You know, Sandy, even if people are Republicans, I've got some Republican friends I've talked to about what's taking place right now, and they are angered because they are saying, you know, even though this Getz and Matt Getz and Lauren Boebert and some of the others, fringe, they're considered fringe Republicans, right? Fringe conservatives.
Yeah.
Are really throwing a monkey wrench into what they want to do because they can't wait to get at what they say is their agenda. Investigate Sandy and Earl Ingram. We've got to investigate.
We might be getting on their radar screen, Earl. I'm not sure.
But they're going to be investigating everything. That's their agenda. And they want to get right at that.
Well, Senator Manchin kind of showed them the book, right? I mean, if you hold the edge of a majority, you're in a position to be pretty powerful. And I think what's happened is that in politics, there's such a lack of cohesion that people are willing to exercise every bit of leverage and muscle they've got. And so these 20 people have a great deal of leverage to the extent that they're willing to sit on their hands. They can keep the speaker from being adopted in the normal course of things. Now, what can happen, of course, is that Democrats can start getting into the fray and getting into the conversation about who it is that'll be a speaker. And, of course, the Democrats will have some of their own conditions for what they want in terms of having a speaker adopted. But, you know, it's not altogether impossible that it'll be the Democrats negotiating with a group of Republicans to decide who the speaker is going to be if the Republicans keep up with this these silly antics.
Well, so based on kind of, you know, where we are now, I think that they're going to make the decision and the sacrifices are going to be made by
Kevin McCarthy.
Kevin McCarthy.
Well, but the sacrifices he's been willing to make are, I mean, he is basically, I mean, I hate to tell you what he's agreed that they can cut off.
Yeah, I think I
shouldn't say on the air.
What he's
proffered.
And he's willing to accept that.
He's basically going to be a eunuch speaker of the House. He said that one person in the caucus can stand up and require a vote of confidence, which means that he could be voted out based on the move of one person. He's going to agree to all of these strictures. He's not going to be, in any respect, calling the dance.
Hold the thought. Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You tune into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Friday. That means Friday's with my co-host, Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, we got into the conversation about the speaker and all those things, but the two-year anniversary of, and I keep wanting to say 9/11, but September 6th is similar.
It was our political 9/11. It certainly was. It was an unbelievable wake-up call.
And so as people reflect now, 2 years later, and we've all had some time to really think about what transpired and the impact of what transpired, I know that the Congress has responded in a manner where they've changed some laws and changed some things where this can never happen again. You know, about 1,000 people have been prosecuted, many more yet to come because of what transpired. And even though you still hear people say that was a miscarriage of justice and the people who were there really, you know, many of them were just there protesting and only a handful of people. It wasn't even just the fact that there was this handful of people, Sandy, who did the damage. It was why the people were there. They clearly were there to support Donald Trump remaining president of the United States.
Well, and, you know, if now that this new evidence that's come out that the committee has released as people have poured through it, you can see that there is this element. There certainly were a lot of people showed up because they were simply going to a rally, and it was a rally of the people that they sided with and supported with, a political rally. But a substantial number of people were there on a willful basis, willfully there to try and, you know, the Proud Boys and the
Oath Keepers.
The Oath Keepers. There is a record of what of Roger Stone having an encrypted phone talking to these people during the day. There were actual back channel ongoings to try and accomplish exactly what was happening, which was essentially a violent and unpredictable crowd charging the Capitol and entering the Capitol, and essentially paralyzing Congress. And that clearly was the intent of a substantial number of people. There were a number of people there who were simply attending a rally who ended up being stooges, right? They were duped into this process. But hopefully the law will continue to pursue the dupers, the people who were duping the crowd into this position. And it's pretty clear that the biggest duper of all was Donald Trump. You know, that Donald Trump was the one who announced the January 6th date back in late November. He was telling people about January 6th come. He was saying wild, it's going to be wild. The whole conversation and his tweets were clearly aimed at generating a crowd who were willing to do wild things. And then the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and the conduct of what they were doing back channel was clearly all aimed at that. There was a safe house all with munitions and arms in Virginia, and a group of people, a whole squadron, essentially a military squadron, ready to bring the weaponry into the ongoing rally that was then going to enter the Capitol.
Does Donald Trump, in your assessment, escape the magnitude of what he did here? You know, he's a Teflon guy. He's been able to get past a lot of different things, but something of this magnitude.
Well, I think he understands something that's terrible, actually, and that is that if you operate far enough outside the norms, it's very hard for, as a president, for instance, if you're willing to operate outside of all of the civil norms and you're willing to use the freedom of speech as a weapon, which is that's essentially the weapon he was using, his freedom to give a speech at a rally and to stir up a crowd, and he will fall back on the fact that this is political speech, that it's an infringement of his freedom of speech, that he wasn't physically in the, you know, there's all kinds of legal niceties that can penetrate and create a defense for the fact that what was really happening is we had a president who was willing to operate totally contrary to the norms. And he did that throughout his whole presidency, and he's demonstrated that a system like we have requires that people operate in a civil fashion within the norms on a voluntary basis, and that we can't have everyone testing the courts and the ability of the courts to enforce everything, because as soon as you get to that point, you get to an authoritarian regime. You get to big. Big brother government that everyone would find reprehensible. So we've relied on people operating in the norms, and Donald Trump threw that out.
So does it mean now then that we can no longer rely on people operating in the norms? Does it mean now that we have to put things in place that will prevent this from never, ever happening again?
Well, you take norms. There was a norm that the Republican and Democratic caucuses have operated under for the purpose of picking the speakers. That norm has been thrown out. First time in 100 years that a caucus wasn't able to bury its differences and come up with a consensus vote for the speaker from their caucus. I guess that norm is gone.
And so is all of what we knew and thought to be things that would had been happening consistently, like the transition of power. That has been a given.
Yes, and at the time that Al Gore so graciously yielded in that hotly contested election, I think I didn't realize the momentous nature of what he was doing at the time. yielding so quickly and so relatively easily without contest.
Got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. You're tuned into the Earl Ingram Show. It's Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back. Show as always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. You know, Sandy, I wanna talk about Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, and I wanna talk about, you know, what it's facing with the pensions, the city commitments to pensions, and mainly police and fire and others. And this was something former Mayor Tom Barrett started alluding to as much as 6, 7, 8 years ago, Sandy. And I recall him constantly saying, you know, we've got a major problem looking down the road. Again, you remember him talking about that. And even county executive, former county executive Chris Abley,
mm-hmm,
who knew that they were facing these pension problems.
Yeah, that's one thing about 2023. We are getting to be down the road.
Yes.
we're getting to that point that people talked about when they were talking in 2015 about problems, shoes that were going to fall in the future. Yeah, those shoes are beginning to fall.
Yeah, and we need to talk about what those shoes are and the impact that they are going to have on the city of Milwaukee, Milwaukee County, and whether or not, Sandy, we can avoid what we know, mm-hmm, is going to be a catastrophe for the city and for Milwaukee County.
Well, you know, what's interesting is Robin Voss talks about how he would like to see some things privatized and regionalized. I wonder how enthusiastic he'd be about having metropolitan government established and having, you know, the counties were established based on horseback riding times. And the county seat of each county was set up in such a way that you could get there to the county seat and back on a horse in one day. And so counties are really kind of vestigial in terms of the concept of what they are. They were intended, and at the time that they were created, they were regional, right? A county was a relatively big landmass when you rode horses, and that's the way you got around. Now with automobiles, counties are, you know, we moved from Ozaukee County to Milwaukee County to Washington County to Racine County to, you know, all the time. And these things are all interrelated. They're all part of a metropolitan area. If you go to the Atlas and find out what the population of Milwaukee, the Milwaukee metro area is, the Milwaukee metro area includes Washington County, Ozaukee County, Waukesha County, Racine County, part of Kenosha. You know, all of this is interconnected because we all live and are intertwined, right? Our highway system. you know, some places, Indianapolis, Seattle, some others have solved for that by creating basically a regional government, a metropolitan-wide, a metro government. And a metro government would solve lots of the problems that we're now talking about with respect to the ability to raise money. You'd have everybody who works in Milwaukee proper participating in supporting all of the issues that are faced in not only Ozaukee but Milwaukee County, not only Waukesha but Milwaukee County. So let's see how Robin Voss feels about that kind of regionalized solution.
You know, Sandy, I've never understood why in the state of Wisconsin we are so far behind on things. A prime example is Wisconsin finally is now talking about legalizing
medical marijuana. Yeah.
Right? I mean, medical marijuana. After all of this time, understanding the impact of medical marijuana and what it does, the positive aspects of it, here in this state, we continue to be one of the major states that push back after all this time on the medical marijuana. And now all of a sudden we're starting to crawl into not legalizing marijuana, but medical marijuana, which to me has been a no-brainer for a long, long time. And yet here we are. But I want to go back to the fact that we have a state and one man. Because this is really Robin Voss who's calling this shot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's anybody else in the Republican Party who has the strength or the power that Robin Voss has. And he has made this decision that Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, and when you just explain, I'm dumbfounded now, because when you just explain the regionality of Milwaukee County, He's not just going to be punishing Milwaukee County, but all those other entities.
Well, I mean, the point is that Milwaukee Milwaukee County is no longer a physical geographic area that encompasses all of the metropolitan issues, and so what we have now is a vestigial form of government. What we need is a broad regional government. Most every city understands this. Many cities have tried to move in the direction of creating metropolitan governments so that everyone has a stake in that which they are relying upon. You know, there is no Mequon and there is no Ozaukee suburban area without Milwaukee. But they have a tax haven because they've got a boundary that separates them from the fiscal issues that need to be addressed by a city. The density issues that relate to a city are much different in cost than a more rural or more exurban community has. So Robin Voss deciding arbitrarily that Milwaukee can't be trusted with its money and that he needs to dictate that there be some regionalized, privatized services. I don't know which ones he's talking about. I'll bet it isn't police and fire. that's going to be a condition for releasing some of the $6 billion war chest, which incidentally, much of it is sourced out of the Milwaukee region. So the whole thing strikes me as this illogical fight between rural and urban that the Republican Party has decided is a basis for what they believe in.
You know, Sandy, you clearly have a reference point once working under Governor Lucey.
Yeah.
On how all of this works, because you were there.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see where this thing is now, and if you go back to Governor Lucey, if he was governor today, he certainly wouldn't be one who would be for what's happening right now.
No, in fact, he worked hard to get a tax sharing program that was much fairer to the urban areas. There's long been this problem, which is that that income taxes are raised from everybody in the state, and it's by far the best and most efficient way to raise taxes. And then the money only gets back to the urban areas or the localities from which it's raised through sharing formulas or otherwise through the expenditure pattern of the state in its expenditures. And so it's long been the case, really, that whereas people talk about how much money is spent in Milwaukee, if you measure the tax dollars that are raised in the county of Milwaukee and then look at the state dollars that come back to either the city of Milwaukee or Milwaukee County, you find out that it's shortchanged, that more money is retained outside of that locale of the tax revenue that's derived within that locale. And so, the ways that localities can raise money is dictated by the state. Localities only have the powers that are authorized for them by the state government with respect to raising revenue, for instance.
You know, Sandy, there certainly appears to be a breaking of bread conversation, if you will, with Governor Evers and Robin Voss. All of a sudden, Robin Voss has basically said that he's willing to sit down now and have a conversation with Governor Evers about different things. Certainly, he shut down state government last year in March, and they've had a long hiatus. Maybe he's had time to rethink this, or maybe it's the fact that he's dodged a bullet in his own reelection.
Well, I'm sure that this is the case, that he's become less of a zealot about some of the ideological aspects of the Republican Party that are derived on the far right in the Trump movement, because the Trump movement turned on him, and I'm sure he now realizes that it's not something that he necessarily wants to be allied with, because it's not going to be allied with him. But on the other hand, promising to talk and work on a bipartisan basis is maybe a little bit like wanting a Christmas armistice.
You're
okay,
right.
You know, it's good talk, it's good PR, but we need to see what happens coming out of it, because Mitch McConnell has talked the same way, and so have the Democrats. And yet when we get down, when push comes to shove, we don't see a lot happening across aisles.
So let me ask you, Sandy, again, your thoughts on if now there is not a coming to Jesus moment, so to speak, with Robin Voss and Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee. Certainly the governor doesn't have the authority to unilaterally do something, or does he?
Not really. No, in Wisconsin, all of the executives in the state of Wisconsin are relatively weak executives with respect to their unilateral powers. The mayor of Milwaukee is set up on a basis where the mayor has relatively limited powers, the county exec, and the governor as well. And so, no, it's particularly when it comes to the disposition of money, that basically requires acts of the legislature to dispose of that money. And you know, that's probably the way it ought to be. But the problem is that this ideological fight, rural versus urban, and the kind of ideological contest that seems to have been set up, in which the Republicans take a great deal of comfort by being able to point at the failures of cities as being a reflection of the Democrats that run the cities, when in many respects, many of the current failures or difficulties faced in the city of Milwaukee are to some extent the reflection of them being strangled of financial resources, and that strangulation has occurred with the hands of Republicans around the necks of the cities.
You know, Sandy, clearly when you look at the cities, going back to the mayor and the county executive, then Chris Abele, Mayor Barrett, asking for a 1 cent sales tax, that has happened in comparable cities all over the nation, no problem. And yet we've been denied that. You have to ask the question, why are we denied that? You kind of want, you're saying that we're not fiscally stable enough to, you know, to take care of our obligations. But here's an opportunity that wouldn't bother the state at all. And yet you deny that. I thought the cities were allowed to. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. Text us that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. You know, Sandy, I want to finish one more segment about, you know, Milwaukee County and the city of Milwaukee and what, you know, those of us who live there and aren't going anywhere are faced with. And there's no question that if something doesn't happen to change the revenue in the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County, they're going to be forced to cut services. There's no other way. And I don't know how you benefit and what the state gets out of strangling the city of Milwaukee and Milwaukee County. You know, clearly, it's personal. You know, Robin Voss clearly has an axe to grind, and he had it with Barrett, and he had it with former county executive Chris Abley, and he's doing the exact same thing that he's been doing. So, you know, even though these are two different personalities in Mayor Johnson and county executive Chris Abley, David Crowley, they've come to Robin Voss in a conciliatory manner, where Tom Barrett and Chris Abley basically came to him after a while in a different kind of manner. And it hasn't changed Robin Voss whatsoever.
I just think that the public out there has a misunderstanding about how municipal governments work and how they cost money and why they cost money. I know so many people who move to, for instance, Ozaukee County so they can live outside of Milwaukee County so they can pay property taxes that are approximately one half of the property taxes paid in Milwaukee County.
Really?
And they like, or two-thirds. It's a materially lower number on the same value house. And they're... their mental analysis of that is that Ozaukee's more efficient and more careful with the dollars, and therefore they have lower costs and the property taxes are lower, which is totally fallacious. The reason the property taxes are lower in Ozaukee is they have fewer people, they don't have the density, they don't have the municipal services that are required.
Right.
There's an immensely different nature of the costs associated with the government in which you have the density of the city of Milwaukee or Milwaukee County as compared to the density of Mequon. And however, that thought process pervades the state. And all of the counties that are located outside of the urban counties have property taxes that are a fraction of the urban counties. And there's been this conclusion reached ipso facto that must mean that these urban counties are profligate with their money, and it's not the case at all.
You know, Sandy, when you look at how many firehouses in the city of Milwaukee have been shut down over the last 10 years at a time, and listening to the chief of the fire department say, we're in a dangerous, dangerous time because we don't have the guys or the firehouses enough to You know, if these fires happen, rapid fire, we can't, we're not in a position. It's unsafe. And you say that, and the state, and Robin Voss hears that, and he ignores that.
Well, what's interesting is if you look at the Milwaukee city budget, I'm confident that probably the biggest single budget
fire and police.
Fire and police.
We know that.
Police. And the state is sitting on the outside. The state politicians outside the city of Milwaukee are saying, you need more police.
Yes.
But we aren't going to give you more money. So, you know, it's an interesting dichotomy. People outside the city have lots of theories about how they're going to solve the city's problems without firsthand experience. They also don't seem to want to give the city and the county the resources they would need to solve the problem, but they've got lots of advice, and that advice, unfortunately, comes in very coercive ways. Robin Voss, you know, coercively sitting on a $6 billion fund, which houses a bunch of money that obviously could come to the rescue for Milwaukee of some of Milwaukee's issues. Now, yes, Milwaukee needs to be fiscally conservative and fiscally careful, but Milwaukee has fiscal...
Which I think they have been for a long time.
Well, I think Milwaukee actually has always been a paragon in the country of good government since 1900, probably. Milwaukee has frequently been an example that's been put up. Certainly, we have nothing ongoing in Milwaukee that looks anything like what has been predominant in Chicago, for instance, or a bunch of other urban cities, which have found themselves on the verge of bankruptcy for quite a long time now. And the main issue Milwaukee has with respect to its solvency relates to a pension fund. The primary cost of that pension fund is related to the police and fire pensions. So it's just interesting to watch the state and the politicians who reside outside of Milwaukee having lots of theories about what Milwaukee's issues are. And then when they come to solving ongoing current social issues in Milwaukee, what they want Milwaukee to do is spend more money on police and, in particular, police.
Well, you know, we're going to give you some help, Milwaukee, but you first got to get rid of that dad-blasted streetcar. Well, this is what they're talking about, Sandy. It makes no sense whatsoever. What does the streetcar have to do with anybody in Madison? And why should that be a bone of contention? Well, you could use that money for something else. Well, no, the streetcar money was allocated from the federal government, what, 25 years ago?
Well,
and it could only be used?
Yes, it could only be used
for transit?
For urban transit.
Right.
And the fact is that the streetcar has potential. It's a decision that was a local decision. And does the state really want to second guess every local decision that's made? Because I think that they could run around the state and find all kinds of local decisions. Maybe there's some Christmas decorations ongoing in Ocando Falls that are pretty expensive. I think Ocando Falls might be spending too much money on Christmas decorations. Maybe we should make that a condition.
It's not funny, but.
Well, that's kind of what's going on here. I mean, it's definitely the tail wagging the dog in terms of issues.
Listen, we've got to go to a break. Our phone lines are open, as always, at 844-967-2789. It's Friday. That means Fridays with Sandy Williams. We'll be right back.
You know, she wiggles like a worm, dance like a spinning top. 2789. She got a crazy partner. You ought to see him reel and rock. Long as she got a dime, the music won't never stop. A roller